Hey, Tim.
Are we working?
We're live.
Okay.
Welcome to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your producer and host, Ben Finan, editor-in-chief at Steinway & Sons, and for the online music magazine, listenmusicculture.com. My guest today is jazz alto saxophonist Tim Byrne, whose latest release, along with guitarist David Torn and percussionist Chess Smith, is Son of Goldfinger on ECM Records. Byrne is also the frontman for the jazz quintet Tim Byrne's Snake Oil, a group you should totally check out. I spoke to Byrne at his apartment in Brooklyn, New York.
Hey, Tim, how's it going, man?
It's going good, man. Good to see you.
Good to be here. Good to be back in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get right into it. I'm going to read a little bit from a review on your album, You've Been Watching Me, on ECM. There's a moment I look forward to in every track of You've Been Watching Me. It's when the angular lines and spacious ideas gel, and the quintet first merges into an oddly metered yet head-banging groove as it pushes toward the stratosphere and a cathartic finale. The anticipation of how our heroes are going to reach their improbable destination makes each whodunit all the more compelling. For me, that's what it is with your music. I feel this sense of journey, and I don't say journey in a hippy-dippy way, but I really can sense, even with my sometimes limited understanding of what's happening, I sense the forward propulsion and the progress, and I know when we've reached our destination, and it's still surprising that we got there.
Yeah, that's good. I was about to say forward motion is the
forward
key.
Forward motion.
But it's always moving forward. Even the, you know, with a few exceptions, most of the pieces end differently than how they start. So there's a little trip there. And you got to, when you're improvising, even though there's a lot of way more freely improvised things than you would think, transitions are everything. So getting from A to B to C to D to E, even if it's all improvised, there's still a method to the madness. And one of the things I try to emphasize is, first of all, if there's an improv, I won't say, okay, this is a piano solo. I'll say, this is an ad lib. So immediately, like psychologically, you're like, oh yeah, I'm not soloing, I'm improvising. Big difference. So it means if three people are playing, there's three equal, you know, it's a conversation. It's not piano with a little subtext, you know, rhythm section.
It's not piano and comping.
Yeah. It's just not, you know, you're not, there aren't any accompanists really, or they're all accompanists, you know, and every once in a while somebody jumps out. And the other thing is, I don't like to end solos. I like things to kind of move like a relay race. You're constantly moving from one thing into the next. There's segues, there's crossfades. It's not like, okay, solo's over. That's why you never hear applause at my concerts until the, you know, the end of the song, because people don't even know if they just heard a solo or not. And things just keep moving in a more collective sense. And you know, you rarely hear somebody kind of finish a solo, you know, and then there's pause and then the next solo starts. There's always this moment of confusion or expression where it's like, something's happening in here. I wonder what's going to emerge. You know, and sometimes it's not always going, excitement isn't always like something louder and groovier. Sometimes it goes the other way. You know, you're kind of letting the air out of everything. And then it ends with something really, you know, peaceful or quiet but it's always moving. It's usually moving forward.
passages of unison, though, in your pieces too. And I feel like unison, especially in your flavor of jazz, is a signal to our ears that these parts aren't improvised. We know that because you're playing in unison. Yeah. Therefore, it has to be premeditated. Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. So are those put in as signposts in the music? There's a stake in the ground here, and there's a stake in the ground here, and then...
I mean, they're signposts for us. I don't really care if they're signposts for the audience. I mean, if they work for us, they work for the audience usually. Audience is way more generous than we are to ourselves. I'm just constantly looking for contrast. So I love when you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I think all this stuff came out of going to concerts and knowing what the solo order was going to be, knowing who was going to solo when, how they were going to stop, and what was going to happen next.
And that started to feel corny.
No, just not what I was interested in. I think because I always felt like I was better at ideas than I was at actually playing. And so I needed the combination of the two. You know, I couldn't really rely on just playing an amazing solo and getting by on that. That could be the music. You know, every time I play, it's going to be great and blah, blah, blah. So I need ideas. I need, I need to shape it a little bit. You know, having these little things. Yeah, they're signposts. They're cues. A way to cue something without being obvious. You know, stuff just rolls in. The timing is always different. It doesn't always happen at the same time. Doesn't always happen at the peak. Everyone in the band has influence. They can decide when to bring it in. Those moments are sometimes how we transition. Sometimes it's just improvise. You know, sometimes I'll just say, okay, you know, at some point I'll just say, okay, let's roll in next group. You know, and we kind of roll in. There's some messiness. And then something else happens. And then it's like everybody knows, okay, this is where we're going. There is a, you know, a composed little thing that we're aiming for. You know, how we get there or what we do when we get there is pretty open. Unless there's something I don't like, at this stage, I don't say anything. You know, at the beginning, the first year, it was like boot camp, you know. Yeah, that transition was too long. Try not to finish your statement. Yeah, don't end it. You know, I don't want to hear an end and then the next thing. I want it all to sound like one thing. Don't solo. Don't do that.
When you say the first year was boot camp, what are you referring to?
Well, the first year was snake oil, I should say.
Okay.
You know, the guys were learning my language and I was expressing probably the only time where I'll just sort of say, yeah, that was a little long or that was a little short. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you don't have to, you can do something obvious here. Mm-hmm. Like at the beginning, what would normally happens with my bands is we play the written music. It's extremely convoluted and we stop and then everybody just goes into rubato, anything but what we just did. The reaction is just kind of stop and go, now what do I do? And gradually, when you internalize the written music, you start using it. Like, these are ideas, you know. It's mm-hmm. implying you something to do.
And you start improvising almost from a composer perspective than a performer.
And, you know, just because the head's grooving doesn't mean the improv shouldn't groove. Mm. In other words, just do the obvious sometimes. You know, sometimes that's enough. Just stay in.
What might the obvious be?
I'm just grooving, so keep grooving, you know.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Don't stop. Okay. Don't be a ball stopper like right. Carmelo.
Right.
I know what I can bring and I know what I still can do and what I still have. So my confidence from that standpoint, yeah, I always have to say, yeah, I don't want to come off the bench.
But that's kind of what it is. You know, okay. It's like you got some good ball movement and then somebody holds the ball and goes, oh boy, mm-hmm. now what am I going to do? You're digesting a ton of information. And you've already done everything, so what do we do with this? So maybe you do less, maybe you do more, maybe you just do something really simple,
maybe you turn it upside down.
Maybe you stop playing. Mm-hmm. You know. Stop playing because you're overwhelmed is different than stop playing by choice. Like right. This is a musical decision.
Right.
I'm gonna lay out. You know.
When you're coming up with a tune, how does that tune begin? Does it begin as a motive, as an idea?
I'm looking for something that's provocative, that'll make you want to improvise. I'm looking for ideas. You know, I'll start out, if I'm going to write a bunch of music, usually I'll sit down and go, okay, I want this one to be slow, then I want it to be dense, then I want it to be groovy, something to get me started. So I know that when I start writing, I'm working on a slow thing. Then I divert from it. As soon as I get past the first day, you know, it looks like a mess. It looks like a Jackson Pollock. And then the next day, it looks more like Picasso. And then the next day, you know, and eventually you can actually see what's going on. And
do you write on paper, yeah, or do you write with your horn and your mouth?
No, I write on paper. But I also use the piano. I like to get away from the horn because
fall into familiar patterns.
Yeah, I start writing stuff I already know, or you know. I just start throwing ideas around, and then all of a sudden it starts to become clear. And then you got to leave space for the improv. You got to leave an opening. You don't want to have it everything just sound like this is over as soon as we play the written music. It has to make you want to improvise. It has to provoke something, you know. I'm just trying to generate, putting a little bit of my influence on it, my little stamp. And then after that, I want everybody's opinion. You know, I don't want to be the only voice. The voice of reason, you know.
Okay, so let's say you write a tune for Snake Oil and you bring it to the group. By the way, tick off the personnel of that band.
Oscar Noriega, Matt Mitchell, and Chess Smith, and sometimes Ryan Ferrero on guitar.
Okay, so you got two woodwinds, piano, drums, guitar.
Yeah.
So what do you come to the group with?
Drums, vibes, timpani.
Sorry, right. Yeah. So Chess Smith does a lot of different percussion. What do you arrive to the group with? And then how does the building process continue?
Well, I give them, nowadays, I give them the rhythm music before the rehearsal. Usually everybody has that together. So we go, you know, it takes about 10 or 15 minutes to get it together, the written parts. Then I might come up with just a little bit of an arrangement, like, yeah, maybe after this part, it can be piano and drums, or maybe piano, percussion and piano before we play this. Then me and Oscar will bring in this, and then you bring in that, and then we all do this. And then maybe Oscar will blow for a while, and it could be with Chess, could be with Chess and Matt, or Matt, you could lay out, or Chess, you know. Mm-hmm. Then it gets a little bit more like, feel it out, and just don't duplicate something we've already done, you know. So if you're rocking out on the intro, that's it. We're done rocking out. We've got to come up with something else now, you know. Just contrast, you know. It's pretty, it's not that different than how I thought in the late 70s when I started doing this.
Okay, so you brought up the late 70s. So let's go ahead and talk about influences. I'm interested in influences for you that kind of exploded the musical matrix for you and made you think, now I have to look at different modes of thought than I've been accustomed to.
Well, I started playing music when I was 19. I started playing saxophone. That was my first musical anything.
So that's a late,
yeah, that's kind of late beginning. Doesn't seem that way now, but right. Yeah. I mean, you know, a ton of guys like Roscoe Mitchell, Art Ensemble Chicago, Anthony Braxton, Cecil Taylor, Sonny Rollins, Joe Henderson, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the guy who just turned everything around for me was Julius Hemphill. He had something. He had all the kinds of music I like going on in one tune, practically.
What were those kinds of music? If you could
soul music, funk, free jazz, for lack of a better word, you know, avant-garde jazz, everything.
Was that a wake-up call to you of like, oh, I can bring in...
Well, that was before I started playing. Then it was like I became so anxious at just being a listener. I said, I got to play, you know. And finally, I found a saxophone for $100 and I started playing. Then I was lucky enough, you know, I studied with Braxton for a few lessons. And then he said, oh, you should call Hemphill. He's in Brooklyn. I'm too busy. And I called Julius. I didn't know he was in New York. And then we started this years of... kind of studying, friendship, whatever, hanging out. And that's when it all sort of happened.
Take me through a study session with Julius Hemphill.
First lesson, I walk in his house. Of course, he forgot I was coming. You know, and I walk in his house, and his kid's flying down the stairs. And he says, oh, what can I do for you? And I'm like, you know, once he realized he was giving me a lesson, he goes, so what can I do for you? And I said, no idea. I'm a beginner, you know. Anything. I don't really know. I don't know what I don't know, you know. So he goes, well, I've been thinking a lot about magic lately. That was it. And that was what it was like. You know, and what he was talking about, which I learned about 20 years later, is that thing that happens when you're improvising with people and you connect and you know it's going to go on for the next hour. There's nothing you can do to fuck it up, almost. You're surfing and you're stuck to the board. You're glued to the board. You're never going to fall. And so you just learn how to get out of the way. It's a major step to know not to do anything to fuck it up. And that's all intuitive. It's all instinctive.
Do you just learn that by doing it and knowing what that zone feels like?
Well, yeah. Some people learn it. I think I learned that really early on. I didn't learn it. I just knew I could recognize it.
You knew
it
where
comes from listening.
You were there.
You know, I was listening to a lot of music with really interesting improvisations. And I was listening to music that wasn't all just solo form, blah, 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 you know. And it's called, people call it chemistry, but it's really just sharing the same goals, similar goals with people. So when I improvise with David and Chess, even though our gigs are all improvised, we recognize when it's, when the magic is happening, and we recognize that we don't all have to play the same thing at the same time to play together. We don't have to do, you know, if one guy's playing a groove, we don't have to all fall in. If you're all committed to an idea at the same time and there's three really disparate things going on, it doesn't necessarily mean you're not playing together, you know, and you learn how to listen and you learn how to hear the whole thing versus yourself only. And then it's just gut feelings and taste, you know. There is no explanation. That's why he's calling it magic, you know.
But I imagine that the more prepared you are for a performance insofar as internalizing...
Well, Snake Oil, definitely.
Yeah, internalizing that piece and knowing the elements of it so that you're able to roll.
I mean, if you're thinking, you know, if you're reading the music, like you haven't learned to internalize it, and then you're improvising, there's a step that's there that you don't want there, you know. And when we're improvising, since we're not reading anything, the difference is the room, the sound, the audience. Those are the things that get in the way. If we're in a room and I hate my sound because I'm listening only to the monitor and the room's really dry, that's a hindrance. That's a, you know, and you have to learn how to get around that. You know, you have to kind of train yourself to imagine what it sounds like to the audience. Just like recording. I mean, we did this record in the studio and David and I were extremely uncomfortable with the headphone sound the whole time, to the extent where we didn't even know. We could sort of sense, well, something's happening, but it didn't sound like it to us in the headphones. Once once he mixes it and does his thing, it's a whole different thing. You know, all of a sudden it sounds like we were on fire and we were, you know, couldn't have been happier in the studio. So it's about learning how to cope with those situations and not just going down with the plan, you know.
And you got to trust what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because you can't, it can't be immediately verified.
And because we've been playing together so much, that trust is there and there's a given that this much is going to be happening. And so if you're committed and you don't panic and you don't stop playing because you can't hear, you just kind of keep plowing through it and you have chemistry, for lack of a better word, then something's going to happen. But the magic stuff, you know, that's a different thing. You know, that's that shit where you just go, whoa, how did that happen? You know, like it happens at the same time. You all kind of go to something and it's like instant. And then you just try to let it, allow it to happen as long as possible. And those are decisions you're making, you know, whether they happen really fast, but the decision, when do I stop? Like, if we milk this idea, did we milk it too far? Are we ball stopping, you know? That's what happens, you know, every once in a while, someone will keep playing and you go, oh, fuck, shouldn't have kept playing, or you know, I'll do it, whatever, or I'll come in and ruin a moment. You know, those are decisions and those are things that you learn from doing it, you know? It's not going to happen just because I'm playing with a guitar player. It happens because I'm playing with David, you know? It's the personalities and the mental outlook and, you know, all that stuff. All that listening, I think, prepared me, you know, listening to the Art Ensemble, listening to people with these incredibly composed ways of improvising, you know, where they sound like they're composing.
Since we are a Steinway & Sons podcast, I would be remiss to not discuss this album you did with Matt Mitchell. Matt Mitchell, pianist, plays your work on solo piano. Was that music through composed or
no.
Was it? Okay, it was improvised as well. So how does that collaboration look? Because here you are, you're writing for an instrument that you're not playing, for a performance that you're not participating in as a musician, but only as a composer. What changes in that collaboration?
Well, I mean, I know Matt. And I knew, I can't say I didn't know it was going to be great, but I didn't know how great it was going to be because I had no idea. He was so focused and on top of the material. And I basically said, you know, the reason it's called Forage, one of the reasons, I said, I basically let him forage through all my music that he had played and decide what material to use. And then we discussed it, and then we kind of honed it. We narrowed it down a little bit. And then I kind of dropped a few hints, like there's some things that I've written in the past that are kind of have these implied harmonic zones. They're a little more harmony oriented, not in specific ways, but sound wise, that I would say, you know, I'm not against you playing these ballads or this tune, or I threw these things out there and he accepted the challenge. He was into it. You know, he liked these tunes, and also he knew what I was getting at. You know, I want to see a different side of me come out, get away from the angular, you know, I want it to sound like you filtered through me.
The angular meaning?
I kind of wanted him to pull out the things that were already there and that he can't do with a band because he's got to filter it through three or four other people. In this case, he had complete control over the improvising and they were, you know, it was really like taking my, almost like a jazz in the best sense of the word approach to my composing. So I didn't want him to just, you know, make it sound like new music or complicated. I just wanted him to interpret these tunes like he would interpret a standard. And that's what he did.
So Tim, you've been putting out records since the late 70s, and when you started, you were putting them out on your own label.
Yes. And so I had this label called Empire. My teacher, Julius Hemphill, had his own label called Embari, and the record of his that was just this classic record, he put out himself. And so when I decided to record, it was never an option to record for somebody else. Didn't even cross my mind. It was like, oh, great, I'm doing a record. This is how Julius did it. It's good enough for him. It's good enough for me. So then I started my label. I had the role model because I'd helped Julius put out a record. My sister did the cover. We sort of worked on it together. I helped him sell them. So I learned that part of it, you know, distribution, whatever, how to put a cover together, where, you know, you master the record, blah, blah, blah. And so I put out, I think, 5 records on my own label. And in those days, you know, it was all vinyl, but it worked really well. I mean, because people were buying records and there wasn't a ton of competition in the independent record zone. I think the first record that I did for another label, 83, with Paul Motion, Ed Schuller, and Herb Robertson. That was the first time I did anything and got paid. Somebody else put up the money. And I was like, wow. That's when I think first felt like I was actually a musician. You know, somebody else was putting up the bread. Mm. You know, I did my first tour, and that changed everything. But funnily enough, when I'd done that for a minute, it made me want to go back to self-producing, because I saw both sides. I said, okay, I'm giving up control. Graphics are different. All of a sudden, it wasn't my product. You know, it wasn't mine. And that bothered me a little bit. So at some point, I went back. You know, I sort of went back and forth. I found a German label that let me kind of do whatever I wanted. And I sort of controlled the artwork, me and Steve Byram. And we sort of took it over. And then all of a sudden, he developed an ego, and we left. And then I went back to my own label with a vengeance. Then I was like, oh yeah, now I know why I did this. So I started Screw Gun. And when I started Screw Gun, it was sort of the peak of selling records. My original idea was bootlegs. I was going to do my own. I was going to bootleg myself, put out live recordings. I thought, yeah, everybody loves bootlegs. So I'm going to put out these live recordings with these really funky looking covers that almost look like bootlegs on cardboard, and I'm going to sell them by mail. How could this fail? You know, I figured it out in my head. First one was a box set. We designed the whole box thing. It was totally new. And it worked like a charm. It was incredible. Then I just kept doing more. I did a Django Bates record, Mark Ducret, Formanek, and it was going great. And then the whole thing exploded, early 2000s, I think. Maybe 2003 or 4, the record business started to dip. And then I started to get tired of the busy work. And so...
Because it should be known that you're soup to nuts with these.
I do everything.
You mail them out, you do the postage, you take the orders, you run the site.
Yeah. Then I just wanted to get back. I was kind of tired of... I needed to get some kind of endorsements for me to get gigs. You know, okay, I need somebody to... So then I started thinking, I think I started doing these records for Clean Feed. And it was pretty much like doing it myself, except that he financed it. And that was cool. And then the ECM, I got the ECM bug because I knew him and we'd always, you know, it was always like, hey, let's do something. And then I would never follow through. And finally, I got him to do Snake Oil. And I think it was a good group for him. You know, I think it had a lot of the elements that maybe he likes accidentally. But it gives you a certain amount of credibility. I would say more so in the States. You know, I can get certain kinds of gigs maybe that I couldn't get before. And the production values are really good. Different aesthetic, you know, in terms of the visuals. But even that, you know, uses my photos. And
Tim, what do you want to do next?
Well, there's something I haven't done enough of that we hint at on this new Goldfinger record is playing with strings, playing David's compositions with a string orchestra, with me sort of improvising and playing with it. And there's a hint of that on the new record, and it just kind of whet my appetite. We've been talking about this for years, but of course, no money.
So this is to
David composing for a string orchestra.
David Torn.
And us playing.
And the album is called Son of Goldfinger.
Son of Goldfinger, S-U-N.
Yep. That's a pun.
Not really.
That's something.
It's clarification.
That's something.
But yeah, that would be something. I'm not that ambitious. I don't want to write an orchestra piece. I don't want to write for a string quartet. I did that. It was not my thing. I like playing with my band, you know. I like playing. You know, I don't want to not play.
That's as good an ender right there. I like playing. I don't want to not play.
I don't want to not play.
I don't want to not play. Yeah.
I don't not want to don't want to not play. A quintuplet negative.
You've been listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. In order, we heard clips from Lost in Reading and Small World in a Small Town from the album You've Been Watching Me by Tim Burns Snake Oil on ECM. OK Rubber Band by Julius Hemphill from the album Blue Boyer on Screwgun Records. Hora Feliz from the album Incidentals by Snake Oil on ECM. I Metal from Son of Goldfinger on ECM. Sin from Forage with Matt Mitchell playing Tim Byrne on solo piano on Screwgun Records. And then a second clip from I Metal. Our intro and outro music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush, performed on a Steinway Model M by me, Ben Finan, editor-in-chief at listenmusicculture.com. Questions for the podcast can be sent to info@steinway.com with the subject heading Soundboard. Thank you for listening.